It's the Schilling Show, weekdays from noon to 2 here on 1070 WINA. News, analysis, commentary, and insight. An exclusive guest, things you'll hear nowhere else in the Central Virginia media market, you hear here on the Schilling Show. Welcome back to the program, and he's here each and every month with us, David Murata. He is the president of Murata Wealth Management, and today we're talking about the valuation of the U.S. markets. People are very fearful. We're in a time of, let's just call it, significant volatility in the markets. And if that is the case, and we'll find out if that's true, if that is the case, what should an individual do about it regarding their own investments? David Murata, welcome to the Schilling Show.
Thank you so much for having me.
We're going to be talking a lot about stocks today. And so I want to do some 101 on investments for people that know that stocks exist and that there's a market out there, but wonder how it is a certificate or some electronic representation has any value at all to anyone.
Yeah, most people don't really understand much about the stock market. They kind of know it bounces around, and they think it kind of goes up more than it goes down, and that's all accurate. But when you buy a share of a company, a share of McDonald's or eBay or Google or Amazon or Apple, you own a tiny little fraction of a company. And if you buy the share for $15 a share, and the earnings, when it's divided among all the shares, is $1 per share of earnings, then you've bought it for $15, but there's a flow of $1 of earnings that's coming to you every single year. And in 15 years, you've got your money back and you still own the stock and it's still paying you a dollar of earnings. And for some stocks, that dollar is paid out as dividends to shareholders. And for other stocks, like restaurant companies that are small, they actually use that money to open new restaurants. And so what you own becomes a greater and greater portion. There's more restaurants, there's more income because the company is growing. And so that $15 per share and $1 of earnings per share is sometimes worked into what's called a P.E. ratio, price per earnings. So 15 divided by 1 is 15, and that stock would have a price of a P.E. ratio of 15 because it costs $15 to get $1 of earnings.
Okay, so if we look at all of this, why does a company even issue stock in the first place? I mean, we hear a lot of companies are privately held, meaning they have not put their company out to the public. And then there are big IPOs, initial public offerings of various companies that sometimes make big news. We see huge fluctuations in them. Tell us about why companies go public and why some don't.
Yes. So a lot of great people are entrepreneurs. They love to start companies. They run them to a certain level. And then they want to cash out. Maybe grandpa started the company and he's now wants to retire and he needs to pass it on to his heirs. But there isn't anyone in the family who wants to run it. So he has to sell it to someone. But by then, the company might have grown so large that selling it to any one individual would be a huge purchase. And then that one individual will be responsible for running the company. But the company is pretty much running itself. Managers have been hired. They're vice presidents. The company is running along just great. So what they do is they do an initial public offering in which grandpa takes all of his shares or maybe 40% of his shares and he offers them onto the market. And so maybe 60% is still owned by the family, but 40% are now owned by individuals on the market. And it goes public. And going public is a way of taking a business and cashing out. Without selling it to an individual, you can sell it to a number of people. And when companies get large enough, it's very difficult for one person to own it because it's just worth so much and running so large.
Okay, so if we look at today's markets, and we've got a couple minutes here, many people would ask the question, are the U.S. markets, and we're talking today about domestic markets, are they overvalued?
Yeah, for the past 5 years, the U.S. stocks have appreciated very well. Since 2009, they've gone up, and they're up again through the end of this quarter. And as a result, a lot of people think, well, maybe the U.S. markets are overvalued. And there's several different versions of a P.E. ratio that help try to determine, is the market overvalued? P.E.s on average are around 14 or 15. And one of the P.E. ratios that they do is rather because earnings fluctuate a lot, they take the last 10 years of earnings, they adjust it for inflation, and they use the average of the 10-year adjusted inflation for earnings. This was invented by Robert Shiller. He won the Nobel Prize for it. And it's called the Shiller P.E. ratio, or sometimes the 10-year inflation adjusted P.E. ratio. That currently is at 26.5. And at 26.5, that would suggest that the U.S. markets are fairly overvalued, so that they are overvalued. And the expected return when the Shiller P.E. ratio is this high is only about 2.7% over inflation. So if inflation is running at 2 or 3%, then you'd be get expected return of maybe 5.7%. Normally, stocks make 6.5% over inflation, so it's still better to be invested in stocks, but it's not as good to be invested in stocks if the Shiller P.E. ratio is suggesting the markets are overvalued. But the Shiller P.E. ratio is just one aspect of the way in which you value markets, and other valuations say things that are different.
When we come back on the other side, we'll take your calls, 434-977-1070. Our guest is David Murata, and we're talking today about U.S. markets. Are they overvalued, and if so, what should you do about it? Should you sell all your stocks? Well, not so fast. We'll get into that part of the conversation. On the other side, we'll also take your calls, 434-977-1070. Ellie stands by. We'd love to hear from you. It's 977-1070. The Shilling Show is back after news and weather at the bottom of the hour. Stay with us. Talking with David Murata, 977-1070. We welcome you about U.S. markets. Are they overvalued and what to do about it? And so the companies are showing pretty good earnings, and people say, well, how could that be? Because, quite frankly, the economy is not all as great as it's been chalked up to be. There are still some real fundamental problems. So there's some little things going on in the background that you referenced that are actually contributing to the good earnings of the companies, which may not necessarily be great news.
Yeah, it's interesting. I have great confidence in the ability of companies to return their earnings to what they should be, partly because millions of Americans' livelihood depends upon their companies being profitable, and they'll find a way to do it. Unfortunately, the way that they've found to do it is several-fold. First of all, they shipped a lot of things overseas, including mm-hmm. their profits, so that they have to pay less American tax. I think the tax hike on corporations, such that now we have the highest corporate tax rate in the world, has probably produced less revenue because every company has been able to ship those profits overseas. In fact, we did an analysis and found that 95% of our trade deficit was not really a trade deficit. It was just American companies shipping their profits overseas to their wholly owned foreign subsidiaries.
Wow.
So when you talk about a trade deficit, we actually don't have much of a trade deficit. What we have is a profit deficit as we ship things to Ireland or somewhere else, and we pay our wholly owned subsidiary in Ireland enough to ship them all of our profits too. So that's one way that companies have helped right of the ship. The second way is they have learned how to live with less American workers, less workers in general. They've either shipped them to Asia, or they've outsourced them, or they've automated them, or they've done something to help lower their staffing. And then they've reduced benefits. They've reduced healthcare benefits because of Obamacare. They've reduced benefits for part-time workers. And all of that has been what's economists call a jobless recovery because companies have recovered their earnings, but they haven't done it by hiring people. And so we still have a very high unemployment rate. And it doesn't show up in the official unemployment rate because by now, so many people have rolled off the books that they're no longer counted. But if you just look at the participation in the workforce, it's at all-time lows. So that's how they've recovered. And that's part of what's gone into trying to figure out whether companies are overvalued or not, because they had very, very bad earnings during the 10 years during the Shiller P.E. ratio. Mm-hmm. So although the Shiller P.E. ratio is 26.5, and it should be an average of closer to 16, if you look at the forward P.E. ratio, which is a different P.E. ratio, this is computed by looking at the expected earnings for the next 12 months divided by the current price. And so it's an industry consensus, if you will. It's a forward-looking guidance. It's usually a little bit optimistic, but not much optimistic. The forward P.E. ratio is only 15.6, and the historical average is 15.1. So that suggests that although there were terrible earnings in the last 10 years pulling down the Shiller earnings over the last 10 years, the forward-looking earnings are actually pretty good, and the stock market is not necessarily overvalued. And that's the debate back and forth between which indicators do you look at to try to decide, are the markets overvalued?
You know, when we look at the level of the Dow, and it's come down a little bit, but it was certainly at historic highs earlier this year. And a lot of people said, well, that's you know, that number really shouldn't be looked at face value, number one, because of inflation, number two, because interest rates are so low, and so people are saving less and putting more into the market, a number of factors. Really, I mean, is there a way to adjust the market for those factors? Have you ever done those calculations and where the market really might be if it weren't for those things?
There is. It's funny. Everybody invests like the S&P 500 and everyone follows the Dow. It's kind of crazy. The Dow is only 30 stocks. They are 30 large cap stocks. But interestingly enough, the Dow is what's called a price-based indicator, which is very, very strange. It does not include earnings. If the Dow were to include earnings instead of 17,000, it would be closer to, I think, 170,000 because the earnings are just not included. And so stocks that pay earnings rather than going up in share price are not very well reflected in the Dow, even though they're part of the Dow. And so it's just one of the craziest market indicators or market indexes of all. It was created by Mr. Dow back in the 1900s, and it was his way of doing an index. He took the share prices of back then about 10 or 11 stocks. He just added them up and said, what's the number today? and that's how he did it. So a stock that was trading at 30 counted half as much as a stock that was trading at 15 in the movement, twice as much, because a stock that was 30, if it went up by a 10%, it went up 3, but a stock trading at 15 only went up at 1.5. And so the bigger stocks in terms of price just mattered more in Mr. Dow's calculation of his index.
Let's talk about a coming correction that many people are fearing, and we're hearing a lot of media about this. Oh, you know, there's going to be a big, big crash coming in the stock market. It just has to happen. Is that true? And if so, what does that look like?
Yeah, standard deviation on the stock market is up around 18 or 19%. So that just means one standard deviation is plus or minus 18 or 19% for a year's movement. And so corrections are not only inevitable, but they're just normal occurrences. Mm-hmm. A movement of 10% up or down is really just well within one standard deviation. And the stock market is not Gaussian. So standard deviation usually applies to Gaussian things, which means a bell curve. It's not a bell curve. If you imagine the bell curve out at the edges of a Gaussian function, there's very, very little chance of it happening. But the stock market has lumpy tails, is what it's called, which means it's inherently volatile. So in 2008, we had a four standard deviation movement down for 6 months, followed by a four standard movement, standard deviation movement up. That's just never supposed to happen according to normal Gaussian. Power laws is actually what governs the stock market. It's what's built around fractals, and you can get a fractal of any size, if you will. You can have fractals within fractals. So that's what, when I say the stock market is inherently volatile, what I mean is a mathematical formula that basically says movements up and down of wild volatility are just normal.
So how do most people handle volatility? What is the human emotional reaction?
Yeah, so the first human emotional reaction is one of fear. And I just read an interesting article that said we as financial advisors, we need to help our clients understand that volatility actually helps boost returns, because the rebalancing bonus is a function of both volatility and lack of correlation. So if you're invested in the U.S. stock market and you're also invested in other countries, when the U.S. goes up 30% like it did last year, you take money out of the U.S. stock market and you put into some of the other countries. And when the U.S. market then goes down 20%, you take some out of the other countries and you put it back into the U.S., and you actually can end up with better returns than you would have had investing in any one investment, because moving it in and out of the markets, out when it goes up and in when it comes down, actually helps boost returns by about 1.6% per year. So the first emotional reaction is fear. The second one is that most people want to move out of things that have gone down and into things that have gone up, which is the exact wrong movement to make. So we call that chasing returns. Mm. And if rebalancing gives you an extra 1.6%, chasing returns helps lose an average of about 1.4% each year. And they've done that with Morningstar studies by showing that the movements in and out of a mutual fund, people put more money in the mutual fund after it's gone up, and they take money out after it's gone down, such that the people who are invested in mutual funds underperform the very mutual fund they're invested in by about 1.4% because they're chasing returns.
Wow. We're talking with David Murata, president of Murata Wealth Management. He's online at muratahonmoney.com, where you can read a lot of his terrific commentaries that you also see sometimes in the daily newspaper. When we come back on the other side, I want to talk about things that people worry about that they should not, and things people should be worrying about when it comes to investing and the market. Stay with us. The Shilling Show continues in just a moment. David Murata is our guest. We're talking about U.S. market volatility, what to do about it. And I want to talk right now, 977-1070, if you have comments or questions for David. I want to talk about people worrying. Now, we have good instruction from the Bible that tells us we shouldn't be worried about anything. There's nothing to fear but fear itself. We heard from a former president of the United States. And yet people do worry about the stock markets and about how things will affect the stock markets. What are the things people worry about but really shouldn't be worrying about?
Yeah, another financial advisor that I know had a whole list of things that people worry about that they shouldn't. And basically the common factor between them all were, number one, they don't have that much effect on your portfolio and your financial well-being. And the second was you couldn't do anything about them even if they did.
Mm-hmm.
So most people worry about what's happening politically. And the real thing is I don't think you should be worried about what's happening politically. For a couple of reasons. First of all, as much as I am critical of the legislation and taxes and regulations that are put in by our government, corporations are still freer in the United States than all but a handful of countries. The United States is at the top of the mostly free category in heritage, and we are among some of the best companies in America, best freedoms in America. And we have less regulation than most of the world.
Mm-hmm.
So you can still go from rags to riches, working hard with sweat equity, starting a company in the United States. That's just not true in a lot of the world. In some parts of the world, it's a 2-year process just to start a company. You know, we could start today, and in 3 days, we'd have a company up and running, a website, we'd be selling stuff, we'd have a tax ID. This country's very, very friendly to entrepreneurs for the most part, even though it seems like they're not at times. And it seems like they're not only because we've dropped from free to mostly free, and it's been a mm-hmm. big blow to entrepreneurs and freedom lovers in the United States. But then the second is the government can slow economic growth, but you know millions of people's livelihood depends upon it working. And corporations are very smart. They're very savvy about trying to get around government regulations. And government regulations are usually regulating paperwork. And you can hire and outsource people to get your paperwork together. It usually doesn't have a lot to do with real things that make us safe. Most legislation is simply trying to protect large corporations from smaller competitors. And that's just bad legislation. But it doesn't hurt the large corporations that you're investing in. It actually helps them by squelching some of the small entrepreneurs that are trying to compete with them. So in that regard, it's actually good for your investments, even though it's terrible for the country and it's terrible for the small entrepreneurs trying to break into the industry.
I realize I can't change this, but it does cause me some concern. And we were having a conversation yesterday with Dr. Hallie Morgan about Ebola. And one of the questions that I referenced was, you know, what could the economic impacts of this be were it to become somewhat prevalent in the United States, even a few dozen or a few score of cases across the country? People stop going out, people stop spending money, you know, businesses are going to be hurt. I mean, it seems to me, not that we can do anything about it, but that could have a very significant impact on the economy.
It could. A major outbreak would hurt the travel industry the worst. That's probably the industry that would be hurt tremendously. No one would want to fly. No one would really want to go to a hotel.
Mm-hmm.
No one would want to go on vacation. People would do vacations a lot more nearby. So any kind of a more extended pandemic of anything really helps really helps people to encourage them to stay at home. And those encouragements really do matter. So, yes, there are a lot of things that could rock various parts of the world. And that's one of the things that you can do. You can diversify your portfolio outside of the United States. We find that most investors who come to see us for the first time have, instead of having invested in all 6 asset classes, they invest in an asset class and a half. They invest in U.S. large cap and U.S. bonds, and we call that an asset class and a half. They don't have small cap. They don't tilt value, and they don't have the rest of the world, and they don't have resource stocks as a separate category. And so diversification is one of the things that helps boost portfolio returns. It also helps reduce some of the localized risk of an individual country. Even if that country is the country you live in, it would be nice to know that your investments were not also all in putting all your eggs in one basket, but rather diversified around the world. And that way, if one part of the world is hurting, another part of the world might be doing better.
So in our remaining couple of minutes here, let's talk about things people should worry about, because I think there are legitimate worries here. And I guess number one on the list is inflation. That's real, isn't it?
Yes. Inflation is probably the worst thing that could have incredibly volatile returns that people don't worry about. It's fine to have your money in a mattress, but if that money is losing value by 4.5% every year, it's difficult to know what its value is. Anything in the market over a long period of time will be doing better than 4.5% below inflation, and that's just a terrible thing. So inflation is certainly the thing that people worry about. Even some of the stock projectors, the Monte Carlo software, they do a straight line inflation when they'll do wild returns in the stock market. And that tends to over-favor bonds for long periods of time, when in fact bonds could be the most dangerous investment that you're invested in, because you get back the same dollars, but they don't have the same purchasing power. And then a second thing that we've talked about is your asset allocation. Just having an asset allocation and hitting the rebalance button once a year is worth a positive 1.6%, whereas our minds are wired for a negative 1.4% to chase returns. That's a 3% boost in returns over what your mind wants to do over having an asset allocation and then rebalancing back to it on a regular basis.
In 30 seconds or so, maybe a little longer if you need it, is there such thing as financial peace of mind, and how do we achieve that?
I think there is. I would say if in our industry, if we're trying to help one thing for our clients, it's to bring financial peace of mind,
yeah,
or at least a little bit greater calm. And I think the greatest peace of mind that you can have is living off much less than you earn, and having some excess and some margin in your life to be able to put that away for a rainy day. And then after a while, you've put more and more away for a rainy day, and then you have a certain sense of security, because you can weather any kind of hit in the markets or hit in your lifestyle, or even losing your job, because you've been able to become more financially independent.
Yeah, it's very stressful to be living on the edge all the time. That's not recommended, is it?
No, definitely not.
David Morata, thanks so much for joining us today and for a terrific conversation. I truly appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
And you can visit David online. He's at morataonmoney.com, morataonmoney.com. And there are lots of terrific resources there on that website.